Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder, and you're going to get plenty more of these to sign up for our weekly Substack, just an email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our dearest friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I would have hated myself as a student, particularly in my late teens and early 20s, and my close friends can all attest to this. I had this incredibly obnoxious quality of only wanting to speak and engage with people who I thought were much more accomplished in areas of Torah learning than myself. That alone is not such a terrible quality, but the way it shaped how I interacted with teachers and friends who did not impress me with their scholarly accomplishments still embarrasses me until today. For me, the only rabbi who I could respect was the one who just transcended any possible accomplishment I could ever reach. I would actually call such rabbis third-person personalities. These were people who you like felt third-person in relation to, rather than just clumsily speaking to them in third-person. You know, you're like, can I ask the Rebbe a question? Can I like, okay, you talk to them in third-person, but I wanted to feel third-person in relation to my teachers. During my peak obnoxious period, a Rebbe who had any real understanding of my own life and struggles was almost a red flag. I wanted a Rebbe who didn't even know my name, let alone my favorite TV show. And this, to me, was the model of rabbinic authority, like this towering rabbinic personality who was, so to speak, the real deal. And based on this week's Parsha, you couldn't fault me entirely for feeling that way. Our Parsha is usually presented as one of the key introductions to the notion, the very idea of rabbinic authority. If someone has a question in Jewish law that is not easily addressed, says the Torah, they should go to Yerushalayim to inquire how they should proceed. Uvasal kohanim alavim vil hashofet asher yeh bayamim haheim v'darashta v'higidu l'cha es devar hamishpat. And then it says v'asis al pi adavar asher yegidu l'cha min hamakom ahu, and you're going to do according to everything that they tell you from that place asher yivchar Hashem v'shamarta lasos kechal asher yerucha. You're going to watch everything that they instruct of you. And then the Torah says al pi hatorah asher yerucha v'al hamishpat asher yomru l'cha tasa lo sasser. Do not deviate from what they tell you. Right or left. Either way, doesn't matter what they tell you. There's a fairly well-known dispute between Rashi and the Ramban on this verse, how to interpret it. Not going to get into that now. For many, including my adolescent self, this became the very model for rabbinic authority, an otherworldly rabbi whose rulings you should not deviate from, right or left. As the Sefer HaChinuch famously states on this very mitzvah, even following the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and exile of the Central Sanhedrin, we are still commanded to appoint and follow the instruction of our local rabbis. Perhaps so, but why does the Torah emphasize so strongly that these rabbis need to be placed in every gate within every city? Why is it so important to have rabbis stationed b'chol sha'arecha in every settlement? And is this really the model for rabbinic leadership until today? Secondly, the Torah describes this authoritative rabbi in a very strange way. It says that you're going to go v'el ha'shofet asher yihye b'yamim ha'heim. You're going to go to the judge, this authority who was present in your day. No duh. Yeah, you're going to go to the rabbi in your day. Obviously, the rabbi has to be present in your day. Are you going to go to a rabbi from a different century? The Talmud asks this exact question in Tractate Rosh Hashanah. What, you're going to think you're going to go to somebody who's not in your days instead? The Gemara answers, ha'ein l'cha leilich ela eitzel shofet shebiyam. Do you really think you're not going to go to a judge who's not alive in his days? Instead, the Talmud explains that it specifically mentions the judge within your days as a reminder that you should not compare the leaders of one generation to another. Do not say, the Talmud reminds us, how was it that the former generations, the former days, were so much better than these? Basically, it's a runner-up prize for the leaders of each generation. They may not be as great or as wise as the previous generations, but sometimes you have to make do and just, you know, don't complain about it. You know, what are you going to do? Don't literally go to your rabbi and be like, look, the last rabbi we had was just so much more competent, much better speaker than you. Says the Gemara, Bayamim Haheim, don't tell that to your rabbi. It makes honestly, in my opinion, does not make a great deal of sense. I don't understand what the Gemara is telling us. I don't even understand, like, how does that answer the question? So we thought people were going to say that to rabbis. They weren't. You're still allowed to feel that way. This is an incredibly strange teaching that doesn't really answer the question. Did the Talmud really think that people who just follow leaders from previous generations because they seemed better? Why is this even a concern? Person can only have the guidance that exists in front of them. To understand this, let's explore the history of, this is dangerous, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the central rabbinic authority, the central rabbinic council of Agudas Yisrael. There is still one today, one in both America and in Israel, but let's get into the history. In 1912, in the city of Katowice, I don't know, it's pronounced in different ways. It's now in Poland. It used to be, I think, right in the border and between East and West in Germany. A venerated group of leading rabbis in the world convened to formally establish Agudas Yisrael, an organization dedicated to the preservation and development of traditional Jewish life. Due to the invitations being sent out quite late, not every rabbi who was invited was able to attend, including, you guessed it, he was supposed to be at the Aguda conference, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cook, who then served as the chief rabbi of Yafo. Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Rabinowitz, a close friend of Rav Cook. Rav Cook actually wrote his Matseva, his tombstone. He wrote the tombstone of Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi, was one of the leaders of the Nation Agudas Israel movement. His work, Doros HaRishonim, presents a traditional history of the development of Jewish practice. It's basically a history of the Jewish people, but told in a very frum, way. It coheres with a frum understanding of history. In order to govern Agudas Yisrael, I'm going to call it Agudas Yisrael from now on, and ensure it would always have rabbinic guidance, they established a central rabbinic governance body. That sounds really friendly, really like a lovely. We need a central rabbinic governance body. That sounds like a good idea. That would later be called the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the Council of Great Torah Sages. Not everyone was thrilled by the name. Rav Yitzchak Halevi much preferred the simpler name Vad HaRabbanim, a rabbinic council, rather than the kind of more, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a little more, I'm not going to use the word, a little bit more sense of self, rather than the other suggestion was Vad Gedolei Yisroel. I don't know. Who wants to go home and say, guess what I got appointed to? The Vad of Gedolei. I got appointed as the Gedol Adar. It's a weird thing, which he described as like being shot with an arrow when he first heard of it. He writes that in a letter. He says it was like being shot when he heard that. What kind of name of Vad Gedolei Yisroel? He didn't like the name. Eventually, it was the Termoetzes Gedolei HaTorah that prevailed, a committee that still operates over a century since its founding. There is a separate one in Israel and a separate one in America. Rav Yaakov Rosenhein, co-founder of Agudas Yisrael, explained the importance of Moetzes at the conference. If Agudas Yisrael aims to always be the organized representative of Klal Yisrael, it has to be led by Das Torah. The supreme religious council of Agudas Yisrael has to be a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, a council of the greatest Torah scholars, the luminaries of all lands. Their decision must be the final word whenever practical activity needs to be measured according to the guidelines of the Holy Torah and a course of action established. If only it were so simple. One of the first issues that arose were the objections of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the great Rav of Brisk, Rav Chaim Brisker, who was revered by all the attendees, most especially Rav Isaac Halevi. Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi actually played a role in getting Rav Chaim Soloveitchik the Rosh Yeshiva job in Valuzhin. That is a different story. Apparently, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had 18 concerns he wanted addressed in order to move forward with the proposals of Agudas Yisrael. Notably, he was concerned with the formation of, you guessed it, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Initial reports actually had included Rav Chaim as one of the members of the Supreme Rabbinic Council, but he did not end up joining. We're going to hear about why in a moment. What were the 18 concerns of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik? It is not entirely clear. The letter detailing all of the concerns was lost, at least according to the memoirs of Rav Yaakov Rosenhein. A great deal of light, however, was shed on the entire episode through the research of my dearest friend, and I really do mean this, there's nobody better, so geschmack to talk to, such an unbelievable person, scholar, friend, really is of my dearest friends in the whole wide world, Rav Yaakov, or aka as I call him, Yaakov Sasson, and the greatest wedding present of all time. I happen to be, in general, a very difficult person to buy presents for. I genuinely feel blessed that I have everything I could ever want in my life. A new book never hurts, but there are not too many gifts that get me excited. Though, of course, and I say this from the bottom of my heart to all of our listeners, this should not discourage anyone from trying. I love getting presents. When I got married, my friend, Yaakov Sasson, gave me an incredible wedding present. I think it was my favorite wedding present that I got, cash not included, of course. And it was unpublished research about Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and the family's issues with the Moedzes Gedolei HaTorah. The research remained unpublished for nearly 5 years at the request of members of the Soloveitchik family. There are some sordid details from the entire affair that did not reflect well on many rabbis. I mean, really ugly machloksim. People literally lost their lives over some of these debates. Until 5 years later, almost 5 years after I got married, Moshe Ariel Fuss, in a brilliant article in Chakira in Hebrew, I'm saying unfortunately because a lot of people can't read Hebrew, essentially published nearly all of the available research that I had gotten as a wedding present 5 years ago from Jake Sasson in this Hebrew article in Chakira. Since it was already published, my friend Jake Sasson then published his own follow-up, also in Hebrew in Chakira, all of it was already out there, filling in some of the details that were missed by Rabbi Fuss. I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. Both articles are absolutely fascinating if you can read the original Hebrew and provide an incredibly important window into the differing models of Jewish leadership. I'll just read to you the last footnote from Jake's article. My friend Yaakov Sasson, one of the footnotes he writes in there, because he wanted to make it clear that, look, I stumbled upon this stuff many, many years ago. I just didn't publish it because he asked the family first. But like, what are you going to say? Okay, I promise you I came with this first one. He wrote in a footnote, Al ze yachol lehein yedidi, you guessed it, your dearest friend, Harav David Beshevkin, that's me. Sha'af hu karas ha-maimer lefnei kechame shanim, it was my wedding present. V'todasi lo shelo gila es hachomer l'rabim. He's thanking me that I didn't reveal the content to the masses, even though I really wanted to. It was just so fascinating. Bechamei Shanim Sha'avru, in the last 5 years that went by, Ulamaros HaKoshi Shebedavar, knowing how difficult it would be to keep this all pent up inside. But now, we can talk about it, this incredible wedding present from my dearest friend, Jake Sasson. We can talk about it now. We'll take some of the stuff. There's much more in his article, in Ariel Fuss's article, but we'll talk a little bit more about it now. In 1923, there was an article in Moment Magazine, the Yiddish newspaper, where Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the eldest son of Rav Chaim, shared more of his father's concerns and objections, specifically those aimed at the formation of a central rabbinic body. Of course, you guessed it, the Moedzes Gedolei HaTorah. Jewish leaders are not appointed, argued Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. They become leaders of the generation without appointment, Rav Moshe writes, only through their great source of Torah and wisdom of which everyone drinks. That is how you become a Jewish leader. You create students, you create followers, you create other Jewish leaders who follow your opinion. According to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the article is in Yiddish, unfortunately, and you are not going to hear me even try to pronounce the Yiddish because it's that embarrassing. His father objected, Rav Chaim objected to the Moedzes because the entire idea of a central governing body was foreign to the Jewish people. Once the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem was disbanded, that was no longer how the Jewish community was run by this centralized authority. In a separate address, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik reiterated his father's opinion. This is actually in Hebrew. Naniach ki efshar liyatzer bizmanenu mosad authoritati kazeh, aval lezeh tzarich haskamas am Yisrael kulo ve'eino taloi beratzon miflaga. Amnam hayu authoritatin liyisrael gam bizmanem mucharim v'gam bizmanem hachi mucharim. Don't worry, I'm going to translate, I promise. I'm just going to read out in Hebrew first. V'shekulanu od zochrim osam, avolo ish shemam hikir osam l'gadoli Torah v'hayu be'enav l'authoritatim avol l'authoritatim ha'im yatzor authoritatim maisi de'adam authoritatim ke'elu lo yakir ha'am. Let's say, a loose translation, that it is even possible to create such an authority in our time, a centralized rabbinic authority. But this requires the consent of the entirety of the Jewish people and does not depend on the will of any party. Indeed, there were appointed authorities of the Jewish people even at very late times as well, but not a single person recognized them as authentic gedolim, but rather as authoritarians, bureaucrats. To create man-made authorities Such authorities will not be recognized by the Jewish people. Rav Moshe's presentation of his father's position regarding the Moetz's Gedolei Torah caused quite a stir. Some question Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's biases, given his affiliation with Mizrahi, a competing Jewish umbrella organization to Agudas Yisrael that was notably religious Zionist. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, arguably the most esteemed Torah leader at the time, wrote a strong response to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, arguing that Rav Chaim did not have any issues with the notion of Moetz's Gedolei Torah. He even claimed Rav Chaim served as its de facto head. We run everything by him. Rav Chaim's concerns regarding the Moetz's Gedolei HaTorah may never be entirely clear, but it's most certainly ushered in a new age of rabbinic authority. A centralized body of appointed leading rabbis clearly conceived Jewish leadership as a top-down hierarchical structure. As my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Ari Bergman, argues in his incredible work, and so much of not just this book, but so much of Rav Ari's Torah has really shaped my entire approach, the way I approach Talmud Torah this very day. I consider him really a Rebbe. But in his book, and I have the link to it, you can get it free online, a PDF called The Formation of the Talmud Scholarship and Politics in Yitzhak Isaac Halevi's Dorot HaRishonim. That's his book. Rav Yitzhak Isaac Halevi's conception of the Moetz has closely paralleled his theories regarding the authority of the Talmud itself. Where does the Talmud's authority derive from? Where does the Talmud derive its authority? This question, first posed by Rav Yosef Cairo in his commentary Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, has two primary approaches. Some, like Isaac Halevi, argue that the Talmud derives its authority from centralized top-down authority, which he called the Beis Havad. Similarly, Rav Elchanan Wasserman suggests that the Talmud's authority is a product of a centralized gathering of all major Torah scholars. All the rabbis got together and they all voted. They said, we're all going to follow the Talmud going forward, which he argued that gathering possesses the same authority as the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, who collectively agreed upon the binding nature of the Talmud. All the rabbis got together and they said, this is what we're going to follow from now on. Centralized, top-down, hierarchical, rabbinic authority. These approaches both emphasize the power of rabbinic authority, paving the way, as Professor Lawrence Kaplan famously argues, for the popularization of the concept of Das Torah. Das Torah, that rabbis, top-down, you got to go everything for them. And it really centralized rabbinic authority in many ways. Not everyone agreed with this approach. Many took a different approach, arguing that the canonization of the Talmud was a function of communal authority rather than rabbinic authority, meaning all rabbinic authority really derives from the power of the community each respective rabbi represents. It's not about finding the biggest rabbi, it is about finding the rabbi with the most widespread acceptance. It is not the rabbis who wield power, it is the community which, through its acceptance of the Torah text, which is accomplished through students and subsequent commentaries and actual mass adoption, that's how the community canonizes its power, so to speak. Yes, Rav Moshe Feinstein was a great rabbi, one of our greatest, but there have been many great rabbis who never achieved the widespread acceptance of Rav Moshe. What distinguishes Rav Moshe Feinstein, and really any authoritative text or opinion, is its adoption by the Jewish community. This approach, which is articulated both by Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Cook, and later by Rav Shlomo Fischer, emphasizes communal authority as the primary vehicle of both Talmudic authority, that it became the centralized text. It's both the dialogue within the Talmud and the fact that it became the central text that all subsequent commentaries and authorities organized their lives around, that emphasized that communal authority is the primary vehicle of both Talmudic authority and ongoing rabbinic power. Interestingly, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who actually himself serves as the chairman of the Moetz's Gedolei HaTorah, United States of America, was interviewed by the New York Times, where he articulated that the source of his own authority more in line with the way Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Cook did than with the actual vision of Agudas Yisroel. You can't wake up in the morning and decide you're an expert on answers, Rav Moshe explained to the Times. If people see that one answer is good and another answer is good, gradually you will become accepted. It is about the community's acceptance, not about being appointed or being given a title of a Jewish leader. I just want to note that this argument should not be marshaled to advance. I never do this, but it happens anytime I give this over. People are like, hey, isn't that conservative Judaism? And A, you know, you could have a good idea and just not implement it well. So there are components of this that are paralleled in conservative Judaism, most notably, in some ways, this idea of Catholic Israel. which is that practice, the practice of the Jewish people is ultimately what makes halacha authoritative. But it is different, and it's not exactly the same argument, and this approach should not be martial to advance non-Orthodox views. I can't believe I'm saying this now. Is this weird that I'm giving this a disclaimer now? I'm so curious what percentage of the listeners right now are like, you know what? It's really good he's giving this disclaimer. And what percentage are like, why aren't you telling us this now? Like, don't worry, chill out. Whatever. It could be it's my post-1840 trauma, but bear with me. It's important to note that this argument that it's all about communal authority and not rabbinic authority should not be marshaled to advance non-Orthodox views, given that by sheer numbers, they are, so to speak, the most widely accepted movement. But ignorance is not acceptance. Acceptance is an active choice made by members of the halakha community who aim to preserve the binding status of halakha, to adopt a particular view. Just because most Jews don't keep Shabbos doesn't make violating Shabbos permissible. Acceptance is a function of educated practice. No opinion or practice persists without the community that sustains it. So you can't say that, okay, this community, everyone in this community drives on Shabbos, so now the halacha says it's permissible to drive on Shabbos. I don't think that's what an acceptance really is. You would need a real community who is dedicated and committed to halacha and the interpretation and preservation of halacha that fully accepts rabbis who would allow driving on Shabbos. And I don't believe that that is the case. That was actually one of the great splits and breakup of the conservative movement, but now we're getting too in-depth, and that would be for a different shear. At the bottom line, what is so fascinating, this is really the argument that Ari Bergman makes, is that different conceptions of Talmudic authority yield very different versions of contemporary rabbinic authority. Is it top down, that it's very centralized, like the approach of Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi and the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, or is it more bottom up, that it comes from the community and really only a community can decide who its leaders are, like Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, like Rav Cook, and like in many ways Rav Shlomo Fischer argues. As Rabbi Dr. Ari Bergman explains in his book, this is how he articulates it, from Halevi's perspective, the supreme authority of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah was well grounded in theory and tradition. More specifically, the Talmudic Beit Havad, imagined by Halevi, was the ideal historical precedent for a rabbinic conclave modeled after the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin's authority extended beyond halachic rulings to include such communal decisions as the appointment of the king, the choice to go to war, and the expansion of the city of Jerusalem. According to Halevi, the Beit Havad and the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah possess similar authority. Furthermore, just as the decisions of the Sanhedrin could not be contradicted, and any elder who did so would be deemed a rebellious elder, a Zaken Mamre, also in this week's parsha, I believe, the Aguda-affiliated Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah held ultimate sway. Rav Wasserman, who explained the authority of the Babylonian Talmud in precisely such terms, like it was an actual gathering of rabbis that they all voted on it, which Ari says he discusses in chapter 3, was one of the main proponents of Das Torah, of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, and was perhaps the most articulate spokesman for the Aguda ideology of the interwar period. Halevi's international conclave of rabbinic authorities thus came to be the centerpiece of Agudas Yisroel and conferred upon it authority and pedigree. And that brings us back to our parsha. Why is there such an emphasis that you must go to the judges within your time? And why is it in each and every gate? As if it would be possible to go to someone else. Is this just some runner-up prize for later generations so they don't look with disdain at their own loser rabbis? Come on. We're not all so bad. Instead, the emphasis on judges specifically within your time centralizes the communal role from which all rabbinic authority ultimately derives. It is not enough to just have incredible rabbis and brilliant leaders. They must also reflect the needs and character of the generation they serve. And every generation needs its own style and approach to Jewish leadership because each generation is unique and it is within the acceptance of each generation that rabbinic authority ultimately derives. It is not just about rabbinic authority, it's about communal authority. The Jewish people ultimately decide how it will be preserved, if at all. A similar formulation can be found in the responsa of B'nai Bunim of Rav Yehuda Henkin, and you could sign up for our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, .substack.com, where you'll get the quote of Rav Henkin in there, but I also have the article from Moment, the Yiddish magazine. I got a lot of fun stuff. You want to sign up for Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, .substack.com. And over there it says that he says we're commanded to go to the judge of our time because we need leaders who understand and appreciate appreciate the unique challenges and opportunities of each generation. Commenting on this very verse, the Talmud says in Rosh Hashanah, Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. Yiftach, who's one of the great leaders spoken about in Nevi'im within his generation, is like Shmuel in his generation. Presumably, like the plain meaning of the verse, the Talmud is basically giving a runner-up comfort trophy to Yiftach. Look, you know Shmuel, but each generation has to take what they can get. Rav Tzadok has a beautiful interpretation of this passage of Talmud. Yiftach is not a noun referring to Yiftach, who's spoken about in Nevi'im. It's a verb. Yiftach, meaning someone who is poseach, who opens up new doorways, new entry points for the service of God, is the true leader, like Shmuel of their generation. Vizehu writes Rav Tzadok, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro, sheshamati b'shem Rav Simcha banim hakadosh. Deratza lomar misha poseach shar chadosh b'avodas Hashem yizbarach bedoro, hu hamanik v'amiti kishmuel bedoro, debechol dar yes hischadshos u'psichaso hu al yidei manik ador. And each generation, like Rav Tzadok says, needs its own unique doorway. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email, you guessed it, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Jan and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.